Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack, who joins us to discuss this week's USDA efforts to help distressed borrowers. But first, here's this week's headlines. Biofuel groups hoping for strong figures from upcoming volume targets got some high-profile help on Wednesday. A bipartisan group of 13 senators wrote to Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Michael Regan, urging him to set ambitious blending goals for 2023 and beyond, based on new tax credits and other recent incentives. The letter also calls for the agency to update its life cycle emissions modeling. The EPA is expected to propose a multi-year slate of figures for renewable fuel standard compliance in November. Two groups involved in the discussion over potential reforms to the federal milk marketing order system have come to an agreement on the need for updates, but specifics are yet to be determined. Following a meeting over the weekend in Kansas City, the American Farm Bureau Federation and the National Milk Producers Federation released a statement that said, in part, it's time to consider improvements that better reflect today's milk markets. The last time the system was updated was in 2000. Both groups say the pandemic-related disruptions to the dairy market in 2020 highlighted the need to modernize the program. And finally, the Department of Agriculture is distributing $800 million to producers who are behind on their loans. $600 million will go to those who are behind on their loans by 60 days or more. $200 million will go to borrowers already forced into bankruptcy, but still may owe more money after selling off their assets. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack rolled out the announcement earlier this week and detailed how the department plans to distribute about $1.3 billion to address the issue. Some of that money will also go toward what he called a more proactive approach to debt servicing. Taking this approach rather than working in a more conventional manner when loans are past due would be a change in USDA's mindset for producers with outstanding debt. Vilsack says it's an effort to keep producers on the land.
Well, as you know, the Congress passed the Inflation Reduction Act, and in that Inflation Reduction Act was roughly $3.1 billion of assistance that USDA was to be used to help distressed borrowers, both in terms of the short term, avoiding folks going into foreclosure, keeping them on the farm, and then in the long term, as you suggested, a new approach. In the past, when folks became delinquent, the job and the responsibility of USDA was to essentially collect the debt. In doing so, that often led to foreclosure. It often led to a frustrating relationship between the loan officer and the farmer who had been doing business with each other for years and years. Now what we have is a circumstance and opportunity for that loan officer to essentially take a look proactively at the farmer's operation and basically work with the farmer, not against the farmer, to make sure that we can make adjustments to provide opportunities to continue that farming operation. So I think it really changes the dynamic, changes the relationship. And folks may say, well, what about me? I'm paying my payments on time. What do I get out of this? In essence, what folks get out of this is we'll reduce the amount of foreclosure activity that's involved with USDA. In doing so, we'll lower the subsidy rate, which will mean that we'll be able to utilize the resources that Congress provides for loans to help more farmers. Every time Congress provides money in an appropriation for loans to farmers, we are essentially allowed to lend that dollar multiple times based on the level of foreclosures and losses that the portfolio has to incur. By reducing the losses, by minimizing that portfolio of foreclosures, we essentially then be able to gain confidence that that dollar can actually be lent more times than before. So in a sense, it also provides opportunities for more farmers to receive help.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier this week when you were detailing the program that it's an especially important decision to make now, not only the more proactive approach, but also the $800 million in direct assistance that was rolled out earlier this week, especially important due to the foreclosure moratorium that might be lifted as a result of the public health emergency potentially expiring for COVID-19. What's the latest you can give us on the current state of that foreclosure moratorium and whether or not an extension for it could be on the table?
Well, it's still in place. And it will remain in place until such time as the Department of Health and Human Services provides a 60-day notice of its termination. Obviously, as we move into a different phase with reference to COVID, at some point in time, the Department of Health and Human Services will make that determination. When they do, 60 days later, the moratorium is lifted, the health emergency is lifted, and at that point, the moratorium is lifted because they're linked together. So we wanted to be proactive. We wanted to be in a position to help and to avoid what could have potentially been thousands of potential foreclosure actions that would have resulted from the lifting of that public health emergency and the moratorium. It's still in place. It will remain in place. We'll have a 60-day notice period that will take place. But after that 60 days expires, at that point in time, foreclosures could take place. But now, because of the Inflation Reduction Act, because of the action that we've taken, there are no, in essence, no delinquent loans at USDA, or any those that still remain will be working with those producers pursuant to the program that we outlined to work through and to try to make sure that we keep as many farmers on the farm as possible.
Mm-hmm. The Inflation Reduction Act that you're referring to did offer about $3.1 billion for this purpose. On Tuesday, USDA announced about a $1.3 totaling sum. I guess any insights you can offer on what we should expect for that remaining sum and when we should expect to see it?
Well, again, this essentially provides the tool and the capacity of our loan officers across the United States to take a look at the portfolio that they have, to work with the borrowers that they have. And if they see borrowers that are potentially in a distressed condition, or see borrowers that are potentially involving sort of a cash flow issue, they can bring those borrowers in now proactively and work through that process with these resources. So obviously it's going to provide us the resources over a long period of time to be able to do that proactive loan servicing, which I think is an important opportunity for USDA to sort of restructure the relationship we've had with borrowers in the past.
We'll be right back to talk climate smart commodities and more with Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack right after this.
It's not as simple as just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Every morning, American corn farmers roll their sleeves up and start the work of growing a better future, one bushel at a time, with America's crop. A better future made possible by their unmatched sustainability practices and the extraordinary benefits and uses of corn throughout the global economy. And the National Corn Growers Association proudly supports and advocates for all they do, year in and year out.
Welcome back. An equity commission formed by the Department of Agriculture at the request of Congress is currently working on a set of recommendations to Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack. One of the interim ideas has been to study the replacement of the current Farm Service Agency County Committee structure. Vilsack says it's an idea that should be considered in pursuit of reform rather than replacement.
I think the concern is that in some states and some counties across the country, there is very little, if any, minority representation, despite the fact that a significant percentage of farmers in that particular county are minority producers. And we know in the past, because of actions that have been taken in the past, there has been past discriminatory activity that has resulted in the USDA having to pay out billions of dollars in payments and compensation for discrimination. So we want to try to avoid those kinds of circumstances in the future. So taking a look at the county structure and making sure that, in fact, there is an appropriate representation of the farmers that are being that are farming in that county. I think that's the critical concern. I don't think it's a situation of essentially doing away with the county structure. It's just making sure that it works fairly and justly, as I think everyone ought to want the system to work.
Mm-hmm. On another subject, Mr. Secretary, earlier this year, we did see announcements of plans for partnerships for climate smart commodities. And then when the program was actually announced, the funding was expanded quite a bit based on a huge amount of demand. And really, there's still some unmet demand, frankly, when you have $20 billion worth of applications for a $1 billion program. I'm sure you know well, there's only so much you can do. But given that demand and given the interest in climate smart practices, was this a one-year program, or do you think this is something that we could see repeated again next year?
Well, we still have more announcements to make. We have the smaller grant program. There were 600 applications within that program. There, as you can tell, there are several hundred million dollars left of the resource that we have available to us to basically fund those smaller grants. So we anticipate making some decisions and some announcements about those at the latter part of this month, the early part of November. So at that point, you'll have a basic understanding of the width and breadth of the projects that we're basically funding through this program. The good news is, as a result of the Inflation Reduction Act, as we learn what works effectively, we anticipate and expect that a lot of the resource that's being provided under the Inflation Reduction Act and the conservation portion of that act, nearly $20 billion, that can then be sort of folded into supporting climate smart practices. We already have a lot of activity going on in the farm today through the traditional NRCS programs. We just, for example, recently announced a nutrient management program that's going to be funded through EQIP and RCPP, the Regional Conservation Partnership Program. So there's a lot of ways in which we can continue to support these efforts. We also think what's interesting about the effort, partnerships have been formed, and it's very well likely that many of the projects that didn't necessarily get funded by us may still continue to be pursued by the partners themselves. So I think you'll see some additional activity and work resulting from this application process. So we're excited about this. We think it creates a new opportunity, a new revenue stream, a series of revenue streams that haven't existed or can be expanded or accelerated significantly over time. And we think it really adds to the opportunities at farmers to basically maximize the benefit of the farming operation that they have. In the past, as you know, we've had basically two fundamental ways to make money in the farming. You either raise crops and sell them, or you raise crops and feed them to livestock, and then you sell the livestock or the product of the livestock. And the reality is that's a pretty limited source of opportunity. If markets get disrupted by a war in Ukraine, for example, that can have an impact and effect, obviously, on cash flow and on the profitability of an operation. Now, if you have that same operation, being able to qualify for a higher value proposition with what they grow and raise, an ecosystem service market where they're being paid for carbon sequestration, agricultural waste that in the past had been a problem now becomes an ingredient in some manufacturing process that creates another revenue stream. All of a sudden, you've got multiple ways for that farming operation to remain profitable. And I think that it's an exciting new opportunity and an exciting new future for farming in the United States.
And quickly, as we wrap up here, Mr. Secretary, the issue of cover crops has obviously been a big component of the climate smart commodities discussion. There was an effort on Capitol Hill to include about a $25 per acre incentive for the planting of cover crops. That ultimately did not make it into legislation that was signed into law. But I guess I wonder your thoughts on that kind of an idea. And it, as a sort of a two-parter, if I may, there was some premium crop insurance subsidies included from the department for the usage of cover crops in previous planting seasons. Is that something that could be considered into the future?
Well, that continues. That cover crop premium continues through RMA, through the Risk Management Agency and Administration. So that continues. We obviously are being very supportive of cover crop, and we're seeing more and more adoption. Working with the Soybean Association and other like-minded folks, we're really looking for an opportunity to double the number of acres that are enrolled in cover crop participation. So you're going to continue to see ways in which we'll look for ways to provide incentives and resources to be able to encourage more of that.
Mr. Secretary, thanks for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
We'll be right back to hear from this week's panel. But first, our Hannah Pegel takes a look at a roadblock emerging in USDA's efforts to promote double cropping in this week's Map It Out.
The Department of Agriculture is taking steps to expand double cropping in some parts of the country. But those efforts might be hindered by an ongoing drought. Double cropping involves growing two crops back to back, usually winter wheat planted in the fall, followed by soybeans or sorghum planted on the same field after wheat is harvested the following year. Ideally, growers get two crops on the same field in the same year. This map shows a side-by-side comparison of current U.S. drought conditions, compared with where USDA is allowing expanded use of double cropping to be ensured. The counties in green on the double cropping map will not require a producer to have previous double cropping history to get a written agreement for insurance. The counties in yellow will allow producers to get insurance by written agreement. You can see that several of the states where double cropping is insurable, such as Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Kansas, are now seeing moderate to exceptional drought. Other southeastern states like Alabama, Georgia, and Kentucky are faring better, but are also seeing abnormally dry conditions. 1,500 counties are currently allowed to practice double cropping on their soybean acres. The goal is to get farmers to grow winter wheat and then follow with soybeans next spring. The dry weather in the fall provides the right conditions for farmers to harvest their corn and soybeans before planting winter wheat. However, the crops need moisture to grow before the ground freezes, and the current drought conditions could cause problems. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pegel. Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers. Excited to be joined by this week's panel to have a really deep diving conversation on sustainability concerns, sustainability efforts, and the potential impacts on the upcoming Farm Bill. Excited to be joined this week by Dave White with the 9B Group, Dana Brooks with the Pet Food Institute, and Michael Dykes with the International Dairy Foods Association. Appreciate all of you taking the time to join us. And Dave, I want to go to you first because we've seen climate and sustainability efforts be a big topic of conversation on Capitol Hill and in the federal government. Really since the early days of the Biden administration, certainly before then as well. But the conversation has really amped up recently. And I wonder, as lawmakers begin the process of drafting that 2023 Farm Bill, how do you think the Biden administration's existing efforts are going to impact the language and the efforts and the policies that we might see out of that 23 bill?
You know, Spencer, that's a great question. And there's really two areas at work here. One would be the $3.5 billion from the department's Climate Smart initiative. They're just now talking to the lead partners to develop the proposal. And I think the second and bigger item, Spencer, is going to be the $20 billion that NRCS received from the Inflation Reduction Act. And keep in mind that $20 billion is more than five times larger than the Climate Smart money we're talking about. When we look at the funding, particularly the IRA funding, that it would be great if Congress could bring that money into the baseline. Right now, it's separate. It's not impacting the baseline. But the funds are much needed for conservation, particularly in the area of technical assistance. And if we could look at a way to make it sustainable for the long term, I think that would be great.
Well, and Dana, Dave mentioned that Partnership for Climate Smart Commodities program. A number of pilots have already been announced. We are expecting some more here in the near term from the department. But I wonder, as your members are looking for ingredients to that pet food, what kind of a sustainability message are they looking for from those ingredients that they are then turning into pet food?
We are committed to sustainability measures in pet food. The pet industry really strives to do what we can to reduce resources, to be able to be good stewards for the environment, but also to maintain healthy and nutritious pet food for our fur friends. But some of the efforts are hindered by regulatory changes that lengthen the time that we're able to get new ingredients to the market. And that's real unfortunate as we go into challenges with sourcing ingredients and the supply chain. We could go in, talk about everything from the Mississippi River to even what's going on in Europe. But there's a lot of pressure on ingredient sourcing for fuel and for food. And that's been something that is important to us. We try our very best to purchase commodities inside the United States. That's our priority, to purchase domestically. But as we look at more renewable needs or mandates in the United States, that puts us in a precarious situation to be able to purchase products from the United States that we prefer, because we see there's going to be a competition for fats and oils and other ingredients that first may be diverted to fuel and then go to human food and then come into pet food.
Mm-hmm. Well, and keeping that sustainability conversation in mind, Michael, obviously IDFA represents so many of the nation's dairy processors looking to turn that raw milk into the cheese and ice cream and other products that so many people know and love. But what would the sustainability efforts on the part of the American dairy producer mean for the American dairy processor?
Spencer, we believe dairy is leading in the food and beverage space when it comes to greenhouse gas and climate change and sustainability, the whole ESG effort. Dairy contributes about 2% of the overall U.S. greenhouse gases. The efficiency of the American dairy producer is unparalleled anywhere in the world. The thing that I always reference is over the last 60 years, we're producing twice as much milk with half as many cows. From 2007 to 2017, we reduced the amount of water to produce a gallon of milk by 30%, the amount of land required by 21%, and we ended up with a 19% smaller carbon footprint. I applaud Secretary Vilsack's announcements of the voluntary incentive programs, the $3 billion. About $700 million of that went to dairy programs. We're pleased to see that. We would encourage more. We would encourage voluntary incentive programs for processors as well. And the dairy industry, like most all of food and agriculture, but the dairy industry particularly, is undergoing enormous transition and evolution. I firmly believe we have the opportunity to become the world's leading supplier of nutritious, affordable, sustainably produced dairy products. And we're going to need assistance to help make this transition to a greenhouse gas neutral or a net zero carbon environment by 2050. McKinsey estimates that'll take $3.5 trillion per year to make that transition. So getting from here to there is where the cost is going to be incurred. And so I applaud the Secretary's effort. I applaud his announcements. And dairy is ready. We're on our way to meet the needs and meet the challenges.
We'll be right back with more from our panel right after this.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at agripulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back. Efforts to pass farm bills frequently involve extensions of the existing law to give negotiators a little more time to pass the new bill. Lawmakers say they're intent on passing a new farm bill in 2023, but Dave White with the 9B Group says if that doesn't happen, moving the farm bill into, say, 2024 or 2025 could give more time for the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities efforts to inform conservation discussion.
The agreements with the Climate Smart are being worked on now. We don't expect them to start till January at least. But if the farm bill is delayed significantly, there's a chance that some of the early results could be used to inform it. I think the bigger thing is going to be the IRA money and how Congress deals with that. What kind of tools can they give NRCS to make it more efficient and effective? Can they put that money into the baseline and create a sustainable funding source for conservation? The Climate Smart thing, I'm hopeful that the agreements they use, the template, can help NRCS streamline its processes in delivering the Farm Bill programs. The other thing I think that is going to be a big issue in the 23 Farm Bill is technical assistance. With this kind of money coming in, it's going to be all hands on deck, Spencer. NRCS doesn't have enough technical people. They do a great job, but they just not enough of them. So they need the conservation district, state agencies, local agencies, nonprofits, for-profit entities. They're going to have to crack the code on how to get more people involved to carry out these programs. But look, every Farm Bill has its challenge. In the O'Till Farm Bill, Congress had to figure out how to deal with $70 million more money. $70 billion. In 2014, they had to figure out how to cut programs. So there's amazing members on both sides of the aisle. There's very qualified, amazing staff on both sides of the aisle. This is House and Senate, both. Conservation title has always been bipartisan. I hope it stays that way. But I'm sure that Congress will find a way to take all these different things and really do something that's good for farmers, ranchers, woodland owners, and the environment when they're crafting the next Farm Bill.
A lot of talk about conservation and sustainability, but I want to wrap up our conversation as a panel on a couple of other topics. And first with you, Michael, because we saw this week the Department of Agriculture announcing some changes to the SNAP provision that allows for fluid milk purchases to be expanded. Wondering, what does that announcement mean for the nation's dairy processors?
Spencer, we are excited about the announcement this week, and we're so pleased that the USDA awarded the $3 million grant to Auburn University. That's in addition to the monies that's already been awarded to Baylor Collaborative on Hunger. With this second award, this now takes us to six different states, 150-plus stores, Alabama, Georgia, Texas, New Jersey, South Dakota, California. And this is so important because it helps SNAP recipients balance their nutritional needs. And as they purchase dairy products, it's a dollar for dollar match to purchase additional dairy products. We're excited about it. We think it's the right way to go as terms of incentivizing healthy choices rather than penalizing choices, food choices for consumers and those that are on SNAP. So we're very excited about it. This program was authorized in the 2018 Farm Bill for up to $20 million. One of our priorities in the next Farm Bill will be to continue to expand on this program and tie incentives and try to match the dietary guidelines with policy so that we incentivize the eating behaviors and the nutritional profile that is recommended by the dietary guidelines. So we're excited about it. We're very pleased. We look forward to working with Auburn University, and we look forward to expanding the program. We think it's the way to balance the discussion around food insecurity in this nation. Feeding America represents that probably one in six families ate from a food bank in 2021. And a lot of those families were families with children. So we're going to, as a nation, we're going to need to continue to think about how do we take care of food security amongst our citizens.
Well, and pivoting to a very, very different subject from Farm Bill and from legislative concerns, Dana, I want to wrap up with you because we did see some news from the FDA this week. Steve Solomon announcing his intentions to step down after his time leading the Center for Veterinary Medicine. But wondering, there's a lot of kind of broader reform discussions happening concerning the FDA right now. Wondering, how do you think this news might impact some of those broader reform discussions?
Well, first I want to congratulate Dr. Solomon for retiring. Oh, he's been at FDA for more than 30 years. So that's going to be big shoes to fill. He knows the inner working of FDA, also has a good grasp of what goes on in Congress as part of the legislative process. And he's a veterinarian. So to be able to do what he has done for the Center of Veterinary Medicine has been really critical to our industry as well as the animal feed side of it. I don't know how many people know this, but the Center for Veterinary Medicine is multidisciplinary because they have to do animal feed, pet food, and veterinarian devices and pharmaceutical. So it's a It's a huge responsibility in that center, yet they continue to be underfunded. And it's a challenge when they have to compete with FDA for funding or attention that obviously over the last couple of years has been incredibly devoted to the vaccines, to, you know, human health. And that's not saying that's not important. It was incredibly important. But it's also very important that the Center for Veterinary Medicine get the same type of are well-funded, they're able to retain and recruit good talent that understand the challenges with pet food. And we're sole source nutrition. So they've got to understand how important it is for nutrition as well as animal health. And then again, the medical devices. Absolutely watching with interest the fact that there are so many calling for a review of FDA. The Reagan-Udall Foundation was authorized by Congress and funded to be able to do a review specifically in FDA. And that's going to be interesting to see the outcome of that. CVM was excluded from that process to be a part of the review. It's my understanding because the multidisciplinary nature of CVM and all the things they do is a bit more complicated. So I'm going to spend their focus on the human food side of FDA in that review process. Expect some additional reviews on the pharmaceutical, which receives, you know, a bulk of the funding. So we're always kind of competing against the support for human and pharmaceutical. But and Dr. Solomon has been great to be able to navigate that and share transparency in the process and the challenges. So the next CVM director is going to have big shoes to fill. It's going to have to grasp both the inner workings of FDA, having direct access to the commissioner, and to be able to navigate Congress and the funding for that, which we always support additional funding for that center to be able to do the best work they can to support our industry. So it's going to be a lot to watch. And I think this with his leadership change could ripple a little bit more into the greater FDA, because Dr. Solomon also was a part of the infant formula review task force. I think he chaired that. So he has a lot of respect within the agency and will be a loss for the center as well.
Well, I tell you what, folks, sometimes those weeks leading up to the election in a year like this can be a little bit slow in Washington, not a lot to talk about. That was not the case this week. Quite a bit of news unfolding, quite a bit of things to watch going forward. We appreciate all of you joining us to break it all down. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers. But first, our Hannah Pegel takes a look at the state of the farm economy in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
With interest rates on the rise, there is a lot of concern that farm borrowers will be under increasing pressure to restrict purchases and pay off debt. But USDA data suggests that many growers have seen their bottom lines improve this year. This chart from the USDA shows farm sector asset and debt values in real dollars from 1975 to projected totals in 2022. Farm assets, represented by the blue line, are expected to reach a new high of $3.8 trillion in 2022. Farm debt, represented by the green line, is projected to be just under $496 billion. If the projected numbers play out, total farm debt will decline for the first time since 2012. A number of factors are contributing to the projected record high farm asset figure. When compared to last year, real estate values are up nearly 4%. Animals and animal products are up more than 18%. The swelling asset and more consistent debt figures illustrate why many economists are not worried about current conditions in agriculture leading to a repeat of the 1980s farm crisis. The debt-to-asset ratio peaked at 22% in 1985. In 2022, the ratio is expected to finish below 13%. Farm sector liquidity is also in a stronger position now than even a few years ago. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the upcoming week. The National FFA Organization will hold its 95th annual convention and expo Wednesday through Saturday in Indianapolis. Sarah Wyant and I will both be among the sea of blue jackets during the event. In Denver, dairy industry leaders will gather through Wednesday for the annual joint meeting between the Dairy Checkoff, the National Milk Producers Federation, and the United Dairy Industry Association. And on Friday, USDA will release a report on the motivations for producers who have adopted conservation practices. As always, stay tuned to AgriPulse.com for all of this and more. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.